Hi, I'm, and here he is. Happy day. Hello, you are live, sir. How you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm good. I'm really good. So I've hit record. We're streaming live. We got the codes going. Hi, everyone. I'm Siobhan Sarna, a founder of SIBO SOS and author of this book, Healing SIBO. If you don't have it, best 20 bucks you're going to spend on your SIBO journey. Trust me on that. Everything I wish I had known back in 2014 when I got the first diagnosis. Kiran Krishnan is with us. Thanks for being here, sir. Kiran is the co-founder of Microbiome Labs. And many of you are here as like Kiran groupies, which I totally get and appreciate big time, because he educates so many people so beautifully about the microbiome. And I'm going to hand things over to you, Kiran, because I want to learn about several things, including those 13 studies and counting that you have going on for the spore-based probiotics, Megaspore. And then also, I have a couple of other questions that I want to ask you about Zen sleep and the stress-reducing strains. And I also want to find out before this is over about the protocol if someone has been on antibiotics.
Okay, yeah. And then did we ever touch on the H. pylori product?
Not enough. It was like it was like a moment, and we hear
the
dolphin. Like, did you see that dolphin? It was like that. So yeah, let's talk about that too. But thank you for reminding me. But first and foremost, can you just talk to us about the studies? And also, you know, there's a little bit of cynicism within the world of research about like, oh, well, they do their own studies and they're slanted, blah, blah, blah. Sorry, some that does happen sometimes. That's absolutely correct.
Sure.
But that's not what's happening here with Microbiome Labs. So Kiran Krishnan, microbiologist, my new name for him.
I like it.
I like it too. Take it away. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, of course. Well, first of all, hello, everybody. Thank you all for joining. So, you know, the first part of it I want to talk about is really the philosophical aspect of studies, right? And when we first started the company, it was almost a no-brainer to us that, yeah, of course we would do studies, you know, like that. It just seemed like a completely natural and reasonable thing that one would do. But then when you look at the vast majority of companies in our space, these are companies that make supplements and nutritional products, the vast majority, and I'm talking about over 90%, don't do any studies at all. And that is a problem to me, because many of these companies make tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars on selling these products. And at the end of the day, if you're not investing in research, you're not really adding to the growth of this industry, right? Because ultimately it's science that drives the growth of this industry, right? Yes, there are belief systems and, you know, people have ways of thinking about things that may not be quantified well scientifically, but at the end of the day, it's the science that really drives it, right? Everybody knows about vitamin D, and everybody believes that vitamin D is important to you and understands that it's important as a nutrient. The reason for that is the thousands of studies on vitamin D, right? It's not just some guru somewhere said it and everyone believes it. It's because all of your doctors know it now, right? All of the allopathic doctors that know nothing about nutrition, that know nothing about holistic care, they've seen the studies. So now they understand. Right. And so just like that, everything else in the wellness, nutrition, natural medicine space, in order for it to reach more mainstream, which means it'll help more people, there has to be studies that back it up. Right. And if even a fraction of the companies in our space actually invested in studies, we would get there much faster. Right. Every nutrient that we're talking about would be as well known as vitamin D. Right? Everyone would have access to it. There'd be cheaper access to all of this. Insurance may even cover many of these things once we get to a certain point. Like insurance, in some cases, can cover vitamin D shots, right? If you're very low on it. So all of these things will improve. And the way I look at companies that don't invest in research and don't make that sacrifice and that risk, because it is a risk, because you could do a study that and it shows that your product actually doesn't work, right? So it's a risk you have to take. But the companies that don't do that are really feeding off the industry rather than supporting and growing the industry, right? Because something's hot, because something's trending, because somebody else did work to educate on a product or demonstrate that a product or an ingredient works, then all of the other companies feed off of that, you know, by making kind of copycat Me Too products and all that. That seems to be the general MO of the industry, of companies within the industry. But the power is in the hands of the people that use products, right? You should demand products that have studies. You should demand products from companies that invest in research and publish studies. So that was one of our goals as Microbiome Labs. We were very clear on our goal to elevate the bar in this industry, right? That we wanted to increase the bar as to what it means to be a supplement company or nutritional company. We have to invest in studies. So that's why we do it. We also do it because you need to have some level of comfort that your products work. You have to have some level of comfort that your products are safe. And yes, we pay for our studies because that's the only way you're going to get a study done. But almost always, 98% of our studies are done with universities. So that way it's third party, it's hands off, right? We can work with the professors to design the study. We can work with the professors to talk about what we want to look at as endpoints and all that. But once you make the grant and the study starts, they do it, right? And you're not part of that process, and you're not part of the touching the patients and you know, giving out the product or even touching the data. Once they write up the data, most university research agreements state that you can have a right to give your input on the manuscript, but they have full rights to publish it, even if it's not good, right? That's 100%, that's in 100% of the research agreements of universities, because their whole goal is doing research and publishing it, right? That's their entire focus. So if they can get money from industry to do research, they're happy to do it, but their goal is to publish. And so if the data is not good, and if the product didn't work, or if somebody got hurt, somebody got sick, they're going to publish it, right? So part of, and part of all of this is getting the study published in third-party peer-reviewed journals, right? And these are index journals, meaning they're on all the big, you know, journal indexing things like PubMed and so on, and they're searchable, and they're third-party peer-reviewed, which means that other scientists or experts in that field are going to review everything about the study to see, look at the bias, they'll look at the conflicts of interest and all that, you know, and then if there's any question at all whether or not there was any bias in the study, they will reject it, right? So that's part of the importance of being published. And there's many layers of publication, right? You can be in the New England Journal of Medicine, or you can be on a much more low tier journal, but it still works the same. And the only difference in being one of those big journals and a lower tier journals is what are they focused on, right? A lot of the, and most of these big tier journals, the, you know, New England Journal of Medicine, they don't publish nutritional studies. That's not what they really care about. That's not their MO. So you publish it in Nutrients and other really well-respected peer-reviewed journals. So at the end of the day, that's what we do, and that's what we've always done. And as we do studies, we discover new things. I'll give you a couple of examples of that, right? Which has actually expanded our ability to help people. So the very first study that we did and we published was our leaky gut study on Megaspore. And what we had about 100 patients that we screened for that study. We ended up including about 50 something patients into that study, and we're looking at leaky gut. These were healthy, normal individuals, meaning that they didn't have any chronic illness. They weren't managed for anything. They weren't on any medication. They were younger people, so average age 22, 23. It was a 30-day study screening for people with severe leaky gut, and then giving them the probiotic to see if the leaky gut improved and maybe what else happened, right? We did broad spectrum blood work. There's a couple of things that we noticed from that study that we actually did not expect. Number one, we saw triglyceride levels going down in these individuals, right? And these were individuals that were not at a, not above the current limit. So the current limit is, I think, around 200 for triglycerides. And if it's below 200, you're still okay. You don't necessarily need medication. And even people below 200, we saw a significant reduction in triglycerides. So that gave us a couple of clues, and I'll talk about what that clue is. The other thing we saw was ghrelin response. That the ghrelin response is your hunger hormones, right? So we saw in these individuals who had severe leaky gut that they would come into the lab fasted, so their hunger hormone level would be high, which makes sense. But right. then give them like a 2000 calorie meal and the hunger hormone levels would barely drop, which means that their gut and the brain weren't talking to each other, because it's the gut that creates signals when you have enough food coming in that tells your brain, hey, stop producing the hunger hormone, instead produce a satiety hormone and the fat burning hormone called leptin, right? So leptin and ghrelin are supposed to work against one another. When you're starting to get hungry and you have no food and you haven't had food for many hours, then ghrelin goes back up to motivate you to go out and eat, and leptin comes back down to conserve energy and stop the whole metabolic process, right? And so, and the digestive process. So we saw in these individuals' leaky gut that we were correcting that ghrelin, lack of ghrelin response. So after 30 days of taking the probiotic, when they come in the lab, their ghrelin was high because they were fasted. Then when we give them a meal, the ghrelin levels would drop like 40%. So we're like, wow, okay, we're reestablishing that metabolic response because we're reconnecting the gut and the brain, which has been disrupted by leaky gut. We saw other things as well. We saw things like people reported to us skin benefits that they were seeing, right? And these are just doing outside kind of quality of life surveys. We had people reporting energy benefits and all that. So from those insights, we did a whole study, 90-day, 90-patient study on triglycerides to verify that whether or not this probiotic can actually improve triglycerides in patients. And then this, we did it in people with elevated triglycerides. And this is important because elevated triglycerides is a big risk factor for lots and lots of issues, yeah. right? And there's not a great way of bringing it down right now. There are some prescription fish oils that do a pretty good job. There are not a lot of medications that you can take to bring it down. So it's a lot of it is lifestyle changes, which are hard for people to do. So we were able to demonstrate that we can actually improve triglyceride levels quite significantly wow. in people, right? And just taking the probiotic. Then the other thing is the ghrelin. So we did a metabolic health study based on the ghrelin response. We did a 90-day study on overweight individuals, no diet change, no exercise added. So they were still eating terribly like they normally did, and they didn't exercise. All we did was give them the probiotic and one of our prebiotics. That's one of the prebiotic ingredients that we have in our Mega Pre. And what we saw over a 90-day period is a very significant reduction in visceral fat mass, almost a 38% reduction in visceral fat, which is the dangerous fat, right? The fat around the organs and the midsection that drive inflammation and drive disease risk. Wow. And so that kind of reduction in visceral fat mass is very hard to achieve. It takes a lot yeah. of practice on good eating, active lifestyles, and so on. You can even have people that they call skinny fat, right? We've heard of skinny fat, which is where they appear pretty lean and skinny, especially with clothes on, but they actually have a lot of visceral fat around their organs and the midsection. Those people are still inflammatory, right? And so we now discovered that, wow, we can really help people with this product and just adding in one prebiotic ingredient from this original study. So then we did a second study on just that metabolic health, right? So just going on that, and then acne, for example, we started working on acne. We completed two acne studies, including the largest probiotic acne study, which was completed last year. And we were able to show in that study, in a 12-week period, we were able to dramatically reduce acne lesion counts by almost 68%.
Right? Wait a minute. What? How? Wait a minute. We got leptin. We have triglycerides. Mm-hmm. I'm going to spell that triglycerides, not spelling it properly. And then we have acne. I'm typing this into the chat. And then we have, belly fat's kind of the leptin thing. I'm just putting that into. So, yeah. What else did you have? What else did you say? Skin. Oh, we're back to the skin.
Back to the skin.
This is on everybody's mind. How much of this product of Megaspore probiotic were they taking? Like 6,000 a day, two twice a day? Yeah. What's the levels?
So in the very first study where we started getting these anecdotal reports of improvements in the skin, they were just taking regular 2 Megaspore capsules a day, right? Just a standard. And okay. then in the study that we did that was focused on skin health, again, they were just taking 2 Megaspore a day for 30 days. then we saw these profound impact on people with acne and inflamed skin and so on. Then we said, okay, we look through the mechanism of action based on what we learned in that study, in the skin focus study, because we did stool testing, blood testing, all of these things, and we're starting to see changes in things that allow us to understand what the mechanism may be in how the probiotic is improving skin. So then we created another formula for Megaspore, which we call Serene Skin, which is actually 6 billion per day. So it's a little higher because we increase the count on two of the spores that we believe are doing most of the work when it comes to skin health. So then we created that product and did the largest probiotic acne study with that. And so they're just taking two caps a day. It's a total of 6 billion CFUs. The formula is a little bit different than Megaspore. It's increased in the indica strain and in the subtilis strain. And that is the one that showed 68%+ reduction in acne lesion counts, right? And not to mention the side effects are your digestion are better, your energy is better. So we're getting all this amazing feedback on quality of life from these people, because not only do they feel great because their skin is looking better, and that drives less, you know, worry and anxiousness and all of that, right? Which the skin dysfunction has that impact. And then on top of that, their digestion and other issues that they may have been dealing with are also improving, right? But we wouldn't have known this if we didn't invest in that first study. Right. And even through that, and then through each study that we do, we learn about something else that we may be able to expand on or you know, maybe innovate around that will, again, increase the number of applications, help more people, and ultimately just improve things. Right. But this all comes from investment and research. So we have a total. One of the things that we really want to look at was the ability of spores to impact antibiotic damage in the gut. Right. In the very first study we did, we got some clues that we may be able to impact that, because just looking at how leaky gut damages the gut microbiome, there are some similarities to how a course of antibiotics may do that as well. We know that a course of antibiotics induces more leaky gut, which is part of how it damages the microbiome. So we said, hey, if we can improve leaky gut so significantly in a short amount of time, then maybe we can also start rescuing the gut from dysfunction associated with antibiotics. So sure enough, we've done now, three or four total antibiotic-related studies. A couple of lab gut model studies, so we can really dig in the nitty gritty and figure out exactly what are changing. And then a couple of human studies as well with our strains showing that we're able to reduce the negative impact of antibiotics by using the spores, right? So again, all that comes from research.
So let's talk about the antibiotics and kind of get that over with, because so many people are taking antibiotics for whatever reason. So you have a very specific protocol for, you've taken the round of antibiotics, let's say it's 10 days. What do you do to help reestablish the microbiome after that? Or do you take them with the probiotic and antibiotic at the same time?
Yeah, you need to do something during, because a lot of the disruption occurs while you're taking the antibiotics, right? And let me explain a little bit to people how the disruption occurs so that it makes a little bit more sense to them, you know, and you understand what's happening in your body, right? So if you look at the array of microbes that you have in your gut microbiome, one of the key elements in keeping that entire environment in check is the acidity of your gut. Right. Of course, we all know that the stomach is extremely acidic, right? And then when you go to the small intestine, it's a little less acidic, but still it's in the acid spectrum. And then as you go into the large intestine, it becomes a little less acidic, but still below 7. In some parts of the large intestine, the pH is around 7, which is neutral. But for the most part, most of your gut is in the acidic spectrum. Right. And most of the beneficial bacteria do well in an acidic environment. Many of the opportunistic bacteria, many of the fungal species do much better at higher pHs, meaning non-acidic environments. So one of the ways in which the good bugs in your gut regulate the environment is by producing lactic acid. Right. And so lactic acid continuously acidifies the gut. But not only does it acidify the gut, it also acts as a substrate for certain bacteria that'll take it, metabolize it, and produce short-chain fatty acids. And then short-chain fatty acids help regulate the gut even further. Also, it regulates the immune response in the gut, detoxifies, reduces inflammatory responses, all kinds of good stuff, right? So this is all the housekeeping things that happen in the gut, but it starts with lactic acid, right? So now what happens is, imagine you have all these bacteria in your gut. You take a dose of antibiotics. Studies show that within about two and a half hours, 90% of all those microbes get killed off, right? Mm. Now, when I say killed off, I don't mean that they're gone forever. You might go from, you know, a billion cells of a particular bacteria to like two, right? So it knocks them all down to very, very, very low levels. Now, what has changed in that environment is all those microbes who are producing lactic acid are now dead and not producing lactic acid. So the pH in the gut goes up during that period, right? Okay. So then as the microbes fight to come back, and they will come back, right? The ones that like a higher pH environment come back a little bit faster. Right. So now these guys, if you look at these guys here as opportunists and who don't like it acidic, these guys who like it acidic, they all drop down at the same rate. Right. And then these guys that don't like it acidic, they come back a little bit faster than the ones that do like it acidic. Right. And then the next dose, boom, everything comes back down. It's not acidic anymore. And then these guys come back a little faster and a little faster with each dose. So that as you go along throughout a 7, 10, 12, 90-day course of antibiotics, if you're taking it for acne, for example, each of these times that you bring all the microbes down, they grow back a little bit differently. And that's how you end up with that severe dysbiosis. And what we showed in one of our papers was that by the end of the 7 days, as all the microbes have been knocked down, growing back, the disruption is so much that your gut becomes more leaky, because all of those lactic acid producing bacteria and the ones that metabolize lactic acid to short chain fatty acids, those are the key bacteria at maintaining the barrier structure of the gut. So those microbes get knocked down and they're not back at the same level. And you've got too much of the opportunistics that are generating toxins and other inflammatory responses. Now your gut is not only dysbiotic in terms of the types of bacteria and their proportions, but your gut is also leaky, right? So we showed that. Now, the key is taking high doses of the right spores during the antibiotic, because what happens is the spores don't drop down the same way as all the other bacteria, right? So as everything else drops down, the spores actually remain at a good, decent level that you took them in, a couple billion CFUs. And those spores are producing lactic acid. So as they're producing lactic acid, even in the realm of antibiotics, it helps the lactic acid bacteria come back faster than the opportunistic, right? So the spores are constantly kind of re-engaging and reformulating that space to help the good bacteria come back up faster and faster and faster, right? So that hopefully that made sense to everyone in terms of how antibiotics will damage the gut over time, right? So with each dose, you're getting more and more damage. So, and of course, there are many reasons why you have to take antibiotics. So we're not saying don't take them. That's, you talk to your doctor about that. But if you're taking the antibiotics, you want to take the spores. The protocol we use is we do the Megaspore, we do the HU58, and we do the Restore Flora. We do two and two caps of each. It doesn't matter what order in the day, but do each of them with food. You can take two Megaspore in the morning, two Restore Flora in the evening, two HU58 at night. We do that during the course of antibiotics, right? Okay. So the antibiotics are 7 days or 8 days or 12 days, whatever it may be. You take that regimen of those three products during the course of antibiotics. You don't have to separate it for any given amount of time away from the antibiotics, like some people recommend. You can just take them when you want to take them, when it's convenient, right? And then at the end of the course of the antibiotics, you stay on that regimen for 2 to 3 times longer than the course of the antibiotics were. So if it was 7 days, you would stay on that regimen for 21 days, right?
Okay.
And after the course of antibiotics ends and you're on that regimen for two to three times longer, you want to start adding in the prebiotic as well, because the prebiotic will dramatically increase short chain fatty acids, the keystone species, and all of those other beneficial bacteria that got harmed. So then that way they can start regenerating themselves, produce more short chain fatty acids, and really, really help the gut, right? Kind of recover. We were able to show in one of our studies that even a week after antibiotics were taking the spores, you were starting to see a recovery of the dysfunction, right? So if you do the regimen we just talked about, your gut should be perfectly fine.
Excellent, excellent. Okay, so what is the I can never get that number.
58.
What is that exactly?
So that's actually one of the strains that's in our megaspore. It's called Bacillus subtilis. Mm-hmm. It's Bacillus subtilis HU58. It's already in the megaspore at 1 billion. When we say to take it separately as well, it's because it's the most robust of the strains in the megaspore that competes against dysfunctional and problematic bacteria. Right. Okay. So when we want you to take it separately, which is we have it as a standalone product, it's because we want an additional, you know, additional backup in there to compete against dysfunctional bacteria.
So in case somebody is new, hi, everyone, by the way, do put your cues in the Q&A box instead of the chat, because it gets really overloaded, and try not to chat while Kieran is talking, because it gets super distracting. If you don't mind, that was a request from the audiences over time. Kieran, can you just explain how these gatekeeper and keystone strains work? Because I think a lot of us have, you know, grown up or educated ourselves to a certain extent about the microbiome, but these are two, this is a distinction that I think is so important. And after doing the microbiome and gut rescue summit, where you and I had such a phenomenal conversation about this was years ago. That was the first time where I really like got it. And once I got that, it totally changed my whole approach to how I understood the microbiome. So if you could help me with that.
Yeah, regarding the keystone bacteria.
Yeah, and how they're like little governors or mayors for the rest of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, there are a number of factors that occur in your gut that help regulate who lives there and at what level, right? Your immune system plays part of a role in that. And then the other side of it is the microbes regulating themselves or each other. So let's talk about the influence that the immune system has as it relates to the keystone species. As it turns out, some of these keystone species have the capability of inducing your immune system to release antimicrobials into the mucosal layer, which is where most of those microbes live, right? And as your immune system releases more of these antimicrobials, it controls the level of bacteria, and it actually controls to some degree the types of bacteria that exist in that mucosal layer. So imagine that you know, these beneficial bacteria are like a neighborhood watch kind of people, right? They know who should be there, who shouldn't be there. When they start to see an overgrowth of certain organisms, they will induce your immune system, which are the cops, to show up and start trying to control some of that overgrowth. So that's one way that keystone species regulate what is present in your gut microbiome. And as it turns out, that's actually another very important learning mechanism for your immune system, because your immune system wants to constantly learn what the microbiome should look like, right? Because keep in mind that these are all bacteria that the immune system is technically supposed to protect you against, right? The immune system is designed to fight off and kill off bacteria, viruses, and so on. So it requires some degree of intelligence and knowledge constantly in order to be able to understand who it should tolerate and who it should go after constantly, right? And a lot of that languaging comes from these keystone organisms. So that's one way that the keystone organisms help and maintain the structure within the microbiome. Another way is their own ability to regulate. So one of the ways in which they regulate is by producing postbiotics, things like short chain fatty acids or antimicrobial compounds themselves that regulate the number and types of bacteria that exist in that system. And then another way is by metabolic processes. So what their breakdown products are when they break down and digest things like fibers, right? So if polyphenols or fibers and plant-based materials are coming in, or even proteins and fats to a certain degree, as they metabolize those, they produce secondary nutrients. And those secondary nutrients feed certain good bacteria that helps their numbers come up, right? So imagine your gut microbiome is a zero-sum environment, meaning that all of the real estate is taken up, right? Almost all of the resources will get used, but whoever gets more resources will proliferate. So one of the ways in which good bacteria encourage other good bacteria to grow is by producing nutrients that the other good bacteria can actually consume. And the spores do that beautifully. That's one of the ways in which they encourage the growth of beneficial bacteria. I'll give you a crazy example of that, right? So the spores, one of the ways that they're really powerful at controlling the microbes in the environment is they produce lots of antimicrobials. They're really good at finding and sitting next to pathogenic or problematic bacteria, producing antimicrobials to bring down their numbers. At the same time, they can produce beneficial compounds that other good bacteria can metabolize and helps them grow, right? The spores, Bacillus subtilis, for example, produces a compound called subtilisin that actually to dysfunctional bacteria acts as an antimicrobial, but to beneficial bacteria acts as food. That's how interesting it is, right? The same molecule, which will kill one bacteria, will actually feed another. And that's how specific they are to our gut, right? Because they've developed these tools that go, I can use this compound, I can control these guys, and I can feed these guys, right? So they play and can constantly orchestrate the microbiome that way. So that's a number of ways in which keystone species can do all that.
Thank you. So the other way that I just way oversimplify what you just said is that it's like a nice neighborhood watch mm-hmm. that is helping the little old lady across the street, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not like they move in and take over. It's about this homeostasis and this reconfiguration of the species that are there. So that's, I call them gatekeepers, you're calling them keystone. There are specific ones that help to manage other ones as well. Yep. Is that a good way, just layperson's way of saying it?
That's exactly right. So keep in mind that these microbes, right, have been with us for millions of years. Yeah. They know better what our microbiome should yeah. look like than we do, right. right? And so there are certain microbes that harbor this really important information. How they harbor it, we don't exactly know. That those things are still mysterious. But what we do know is that they do manage the microbiome. And when they are gone, things go awry and the microbiome gets all messed up and you get all kinds of opportunists and all fighting each other and creating a mess, right? So they are regulators of the microbiome and they have the in-depth information over millions of years of coevolution on what the microbiome should look like. And at the end of the day, then the question becomes like, why do they have this knowledge, right? Many of these organisms exist only in our gut. Right? They don't exist necessarily in the outside environment. Many of them are anaerobic and they're called obligate anaerobes, meaning oxygen is actually toxic to them, right? We live in an oxygen world, right? Where the outside environment is oxygenated. But imagine that these microbes have developed this capability or in some ways you would say inability to deal with oxygen in the outside normal earth environment. So they've developed places in the world that are unique anaerobic homes, meaning they don't have oxygen in these environments. The human gut is one of those, right? So millions of years ago, they took shelter in the human gut. And for them, we are their host, right? They live within us. And so our health and our prosperity is their health and their prosperity. If we don't exist as a species, they may not exist as a species as well. And so because of that, that programming, that ability to survive, you know, and nature always finds a way to kind of survive and make it through, right? So their need to survive has caused them to develop a certain level of intelligence on understanding what this host environment should look like. Right. And so it's super fascinating when you think about it. But it, you know, fortunately, we didn't have to design any of this. It just happened. Right. And, right. and we just have to be smart enough to try to understand it, you know, and utilize it.
And so a couple of questions. We have a ton of questions. So I want to sort of do a couple of things right now, but I want to do a terminology check. What is the difference between soil-based and spore probiotics?
Yeah. So these are often conflated terms, right? So we want to be careful because what I started hearing years ago was that, so all soil-based organisms are spores. That's not true, right? There are very few organisms that are spores. 99.9% of organisms in soil are not spore-based probiotics. And most spore-based probiotics, if you have the right strains, are not soil-based. So when you say soil-based, at least when we say it, and we typically talk about it in research, soil-based means that the home of the organism is in the soil, right? Their function is in the soil. And of course, the soil has lots and lots of very important organisms that are important for the health of the soil. Now, getting exposure to those organisms is a good thing. So getting out, getting dirty, it stimulates your system and helps diversify your environment in many ways. But at the end of the day, when we want to distinguish the terms, soil-based are typically organisms that live and work in the soil.
Okay.
And spore-based are spore-forming organisms that are commensals, meaning that they live in the gut, but they use the soil as a vector to get from host to host, right? So okay. Remember when we got a huge majority of our microbiome when we were first born, right? Hopefully we passed through the vaginal canal. If we did not, we came out, you know, through a C-section and we picked up lots of microbes in the hospital environment. But then close contact with mom and dad and hopefully breastfeeding and nursing, we started getting lots of our gut bacteria from mom and dad, from nursing, from passing through the vaginal canal. And within the first couple of years of things we came in contact with, we touched, we ate, and so on. The rest of your life, you're not getting exposure to those organisms anymore, right? Most of us are not breastfeeding the rest of our lives, right? Most of us are not flying through vaginas for the rest of our lives. We tend to do that just once, right?
Yeah.
We don't get that exposure anymore, but we do get exposure from the environment. And there are certain commensal bacteria like the spores, like Bacillus spores, that have developed the ability to transmit from person to person through the environment and not just from that initial inoculum that we got. Right. Most of our other species, the bifidos and the lactose and all the ones that we have in our gut, most of them we typically get, one period of exposure in the beginning, and then the rest of your life, you're exposed to things in the environment. Spores are one of those commensals that you get from the environment.
Okay. We have from Natasha a question that you and I have already decided to talk about, which is my doctor suggests me to take the probiotic for H. pylori. So could you talk about that? And then also she's concerned because there's some corn in one of the ingredients there. So could you address that, please?
Oh, yeah. Yes. So the H. pylori product, it's called PyloGuard, right? Yeah. So this is a lactobacillus reuteri. And it's not even alive, actually. It's an attenuated strain, and it doesn't have to be alive, right? Which is the beauty of this species. It has developed on its own a natural affinity for the cell membrane structure of Helicobacter pylori. So it has all these binding sites on its outer membrane that has an affinity and binds up against H. pylori. And then what's really even cooler about that is it's not a one-to-one. You actually can see a bunch of these microbes actually bind several H. pylori. In terms of size, they're a little bit smaller than H. pylori. So you can see four or five of these lactobacilli basically surrounding and binding up H. pylori. We call it co-aggregation, right? So when you take the product, and the way the product works is you open up a capsule, and then you put it in water and you mix it and you drink it. And the reason why we want you to do that, and yeah, it explains here how you do that. And we've added a tinge of mixed berry flavor in it just so there's some experience with drinking it. But you drink it with 8-9 ounces of water or something like that. And what that does is it spreads that microbe all throughout the lining of your stomach. Right. And then that increases the opportunity for that microbe to bump up against H. pylori, grab it, and then take it out of the system. So you basically defecate it out. There's nothing else it does in the system. That's the one and only thing it does, which is really, really fascinating when you look at it. But this microbe has naturally developed this capability. And we were able to screen thousands and thousands of microbes that we have in our library to find this kind of capability, because we were looking at H. pylori and we're going, wow, the current treatment for it is pretty harsh on the system, right? Because you're taking two antibiotics, you're taking a PPI. And so if your doctor is telling you that's what you have to take, that's what you have to take. But you know, if your doctor's open to alternatives and you talk to them about it, then this gives you another option of trying to have kind of healthier levels of it within the system. The corn thing, the carrier system comes from a corn dextrin, It's a fiber from corn, which is unfortunate. We're working to shift that at some point, but that was the most, the best stabilizing compound. But, you know, think about it this way, right? So very few people have a full-on corn allergy, and corn is not listed as one of the, you know, big 13 allergens or whatever, the big eight, big nine. I can't remember what that number is. Yeah. Some people do have a sensitivity to corn, and more often than not, it's the proteins within corn. So there aren't any proteins in here. If you have an allergy or an anaphylactic response to corn, then it's something that you shouldn't take. But if right. you have a sensitivity, we're looking at as little as, I think it's 100, 150 milligrams in there. So the benefit that you get from co-aggregating and taking H. pylori out far, far, far outweigh any potential response you might get to 150 milligrams or so of corn, right? Okay. Yeah.
All right, let me just keep going because we have only like 18 minutes left. So I've heard some probiotics can trigger histamines. Do the ones you offer do this? So multiple questions about MCAS, histamines, et cetera.
Yeah.
Could you address that, please, sir?
Yeah, absolutely. So why would a probiotic trigger histamine, right? So that's a question to ask. So if somebody is already inclined to a histamine response, which means that you likely have more IgE, more activated eosinophils and basophils as part of your immune repertoire, that's the way your body angles itself, then anything you experience, your body is exposed to that requires immune response will typically create a histamine type of response. Right? Now, why do some probiotics induce histamine? Is because many of those probiotics that you have access to, that again, back to our original conversation, were never really researched, they elicit an immune response to your system because your immune system does not recognize them as self microbes, right? They are non-self microbes. And there's no history of those microbes being exposed to the adult system throughout the years. And so, you know, when someone formulates a product like that and takes 15 random strains and throws them together, and you're not really sure where those strains came from or why your system would be exposed to it, you add in billions of those strains into your system, you're gonna elicit an immune response because to your body, it's billions of bacteria coming in that it doesn't recognize, right? And because your body's already leaning towards eosinophil, basophil, IgE response, it responds with histamine, right? That's what it does. So in histamine, typically it's histamine and taurine, which then leads to activated IgE, and then you get all of this sensitivities to it. So the probiotics, because they're not well-researched, they're not well-formulated, they don't use the right strains, are just eliciting an immune response, and your body's already leaning towards histamine, right? Now, there's a difference with the spores, because the spores are recognized by your system as commensal bacteria. That's the natural order of things because it's completely natural for you to get exposed to these types of strains as you're walking around living life and so on in the outside environment, right? So it's a completely natural part of our programming to see and recognize spores. In fact, spores have an immune modulatory effect. They can actually break down and metabolize histamine to a certain degree. They can actually modulate your immune system to increase IL-10, which reduces the inflammatory response, which is part of the histamine repertoire. They can actually increase that Treg system, which reduces the eosinophil basophil response and provides more tolerance, right? And in fact, that's part of getting over a high histamine, hypersensitive type of system is getting more exposure to the outside environment, to more microbes through the environment and so on, right? And there's been big, big allergy studies and all that have looked at that, where avoidance is actually not a great way of going about it, but more exposure to natural environmental bacteria seems to have a positive response, right? Big, big studies being done in Finland, for example, on all of this. And so taking the spores is actually the same as getting outside exposure to these types of microbes. So that's the big difference between why some probiotics elicit a histamine response and why some don't, is some are naturally attuned to you being exposed to them, and others aren't. And your immune system is going to respond to those.
Okay, what I want to do is show everybody your site. So a couple of things. There is a price increase that's happening June 1st, which is the first time you've ever increased prices. When did you guys start this business? I can't remember.
2013. So we've never increased prices since 2013.
A long ass time to not increase your prices. So there are a variety of reasons. I'm sure you've seen other situations out there with the supply chain that have price increases. We've given you a month notice. And also we still have a 15% coupon for you. If you go in through our link and you use the coupon code, it's all listed there in chat. Please look at that. So thank you for that, Karen. I really do appreciate it. We all do. Now, a lot of times I have a good cool coupon code from Karen, but it's only for new customers, but this even works for existing customers. So please don't hesitate. You have a limited time there. And sometimes things do sell out. So I want to make sure you get it, but whatever you want. So a couple of questions have come in about like, what is the name of the skin product, Karen?
Mm-hmm. It's called Serene Skin.
Here's what it looks like. You guys have the links in the chat. I'm not going to have him get into the science too much of this. Here's why. If you, Clarissa has also put a link into all, I don't know why that's being black right now, but you get the idea, to all of the previous talks I've done with Karen. So it's free. You can go in there and look at all kinds of topics. And she put the link in there. When we send this to you, the recording, you'll also get access to that same link. So go check out what Karen has been talking about with us for so long. And Karen, Megaspore is that, do you have a bottle of it by any chance?
I do, yeah.
Can you grab it? Because I wanted to show this to everybody. You may have seen this bottle floating around the internet or floating around at your practitioner's office. This is what we're talking about.
Right.
So if you've like, oh, I've seen that around, didn't know that much about it. That's what we've been primarily talking about today. And so how long does the protocol for H. pylori usually take? Does it take longer than a month? I'm kind of popping around.
Most of our studies are done at 14 or 21 days. So, but we recommend people take it for about a month. The bottle is designed to be a month bottle. Most people should be okay at the end of a month. We also encourage you, if you have H. pylori related issues, it's important to get other people in your household to take it too. Because the problem with H. pylori, it's super transmissible between people in the same household. So you'll just keep getting re-exposed to it if the other people in the household, you know, are maybe carriers of it and spewing it out. So
yeah, thank you for that. Is the coupon for patients or practitioners? Well, ultimately it's for both. I mean, if you're a practitioner and you don't have an account with Microbiome Labs, you can use it, but it's certainly designed for patients. And so that I just took care of. Let's see. Can we take multiple products together like Polyguard, Megaspore, HU58, et cetera?
Yeah. I mean, we have a lot of SIBO patients that take a number of the products together. Right. We have a number of SIBO patients that take Megaspore, HU58, MegaGuard, PyloGuard, because H. pylori is associated with at least 50% of SIBO cases. You could take a number of them together. All of these products are designed to address a different mechanism of action or pathology that impacts these conditions, right? So none of them overlap much. The only one that overlaps is the Serene Skin and the Megaspore. They have very similar function in the body, but the Serene Skin is geared a little bit more towards having that skin impact. But outside of that, I mean, yeah, you can absolutely, depending on what you're dealing with, take a lot of them together.
And how long does it usually take for people to see a difference with Serene Skin?
So our first study was 30 days and we saw 35% reduction in lesions, acne-related lesions, total lesions and inflammatory lesions. So in 30 days, you'll see a measurable difference. But our second study was a 90-day study. So 90 days is where you see the real profound changes, awesome. Which is super exciting.
Lisa's asking a great question and making a point. Isn't H. pylori part of the typical American stomach and setup? We're talking about the overgrowth, right?
Yes. So
it's everything we were talking about before, about the keystone, bringing things back into homeostasis. If you have SIBO and SIFO, by the way, which is an overgrowth of fungal or candida overgrown in the small intestine, and also bacteria or archaea overgrowing in the small intestine. So this is the thing. Some people do beautifully with probiotics, and Megaspore in particular, when you have SIBO. This is highly personalized. It is your unique snowflake microbiome. So you have to start slow and you have to test to see how it does for you. It's not everything's for everybody, right? Everyone has an individual microbiome. So Kieran, somebody's also asked about how you get started. Especially if you're highly sensitive. Like I've of course seen people take and open the capsule and do like the tiniest, like an eighth of a teaspoon in applesauce or whatever, which is high FODMAP for those of you who are keeping track. But how can you help people get started?
Yeah. And then let me just answer that H. pylori question too, real quick.
Yeah.
Most people get exposed to H. pylori at some point, usually when you're younger, 6, 7, 8 years old, especially when you start sharing things with friends and within the family and all that. And you could have, and these numbers may not make sense to you, but I promise they scientifically, they make sense. You can have 10 to the 2 CFUs per ml of aspirate or, small bowel aspirate as a number of H. pylori in your gut for the rest of your life and be fine. Right? The moment it goes above that 10 to the 5 is when we start to see problems, because it eats away at the lining of your stomach. It elicits some of the most profound inflammatory responses throughout the body. That's why now H. pylori is being seen as being associated with fertility issues, autoimmune, systemic cancers, of course, stomach cancers and all that, because of the type of inflammatory responses it elicits. So most of that is seen once you exceed that 10 to the 5 level. And the estimate is at least 50% of adults have above that 10 to the 5 level, have that infectious level of H. pylori. So that's really where we get concerned about it. With Megaspore, when we first got the product, we had about 1,000 patients over a course of a year start on the product to be able to observe, and figure out how they were dealing with the product. We found that 10% of them would have Herxheimer or detox reactions if they went with the full 2 caps right off the bat, right? But what was interesting is we couldn't predict who would have that response. Sometimes it's kind of the very sensitive, more sickly patients. Sometimes it's people that seem perfectly fine, but they have all kinds of dysbiosis that drives that type of Herxheimer reaction. So for that reason, we started tapering everybody up, and everybody starts with either half a capsule or 1 capsule every other day, right? If you know you are ultra sensitive to things and everything you take causes issues for you, then you would be the half a capsule, even a quarter capsule person every other day. And you do that for a week. And then you go to doing that same level, whether it's a quarter, half, or 1 capsule, you do that every day, right? And then once you get to the everyday part, you do that for a week, and then you try to bump up that dose. So if you are at 1 capsule, you'd go to 2. If you're at half a capsule, you go to 1. If you're at a quarter capsule, you go to half, and so on, right? So week 1, you're doing it every other day, small dose. Week 2, you're doing every day, small dose. Week 3, you're starting to double that small dose, working your way up to 2 caps a day. You always take it with food, take it any time of the day, and just kind of work your way up. Now, every time you bump it up, whether it's doing it every day from half a day, from every other day, or going from 1 cap to 2 or half cap to 1, every time you bump it up, if you feel like the response is too uncomfortable, you're getting too much cramping, bloating, loose stool, just back it back down for another week and then work your way up slowly, right? It's totally fine to go slow on it. It's better just to be comfortable. And so, but if you can stand it and it's like a little bit of cramping, a little bit of loose stool, and you're fine with it, then just keep moving forward. Usually that alleviates within a few days. Who's the kitty? I don't think I've seen your kitty.
We have new kitty.
This is
Petunia. Petunia is a rescue from Brooklyn.
Oh,
and
Petunia.
And she's so sweet and very skittish still.
Oh, poor thing. She looks a lot like a kitty I had in high school.
Oh, really?
Yeah, same kind of black and white.
A tuxedo.
Yeah, a little tuxedo.
And she has a beautiful brother named George. And apparently Brooklyn has like a lot of rescue cats that need love. So just FYI. Oh. But we're infatuated with them and they're coming along nicely. So if you see me reaching down, that's like me trying to make contact with them. I literally moved my entire production into my bedroom. I've been like to do this so that they would be in the same room with me because they're highly freaked out. Anyway,
cat mama.
Yeah, I love them. Okay, so you kind of touched on this. This is about reseeding the gut. And also someone has a patient who says things like, oh, I don't want to take Megaspore and spore-based probiotics because they're going to take over my gut. That is a myth that has been perpetuated for, like 5 or 6 years ago, I did read about that more often, but Kieran has done so much work to mitigate that myth. Thank goodness. I have a patient concerned that it's being a sporin that could take over the gut and be difficult to eradicate. They're considering it like C. diff. What's the best response to that argument, or what's the reason why that doesn't happen?
The response I would give to that patient is, if they're concerned that spores take over the gut, please never go outside. Okay. Because if you go outside in nature, don't ever go to the beach, don't ever go on a walk in the woods, don't ever go on parks, trails, any of that, because it's all lots of spores in all those environments, right? So if that's your concern about spores, then humans wouldn't exist today, because spores have been here far longer than we have, and they're on every corner of the earth, and our ancestors have been consuming them. We know this, it's verified. We have glacial ice core studies and all have verified the level of spores in the environment and the level of spores in the natural human gut, right? And so we don't exceed a certain number. We know that. And why do we know that? Because we invest in studies. And we've done 13 studies, 14 studies, and we're doing more every day. And we have probably, I would estimate around, 800,000, 900,000 patients that take it a year, right? Wow. And have been for about 8 years. So we have a lot of data, and both empirical study data and all that. We have also gut microbiome test. We have a test that we've been doing, the Biome Effects, for now 2.5 years. We have over 10,000 gut microbiome tests done on people that take spores. There's not a single inclination that spores take over. They don't. It's just not what they do. So it's just one of those myths. And I would recommend to that patient, if they're truly concerned, that they never leave their house.
In a loving way, we get the point.
Like, yes, exactly.
So I just wanted to also show you that the stool test. I know we're running out of time, but I did want to show this to you. And you guys have such great questions. Hi, Kitty. And I appreciate you being here. Hold on. Here, you have a new test. So you have here it is, the gut microbiome. Is that what it's showing? The biome FX and the biome? Okay, so it's a vaginal microbiome and then the gut microbiome. Both of these tests are phenomenal. And the gut microbiome is what he was just talking about, the stool test. Vaginal is new, actually.
Yeah. It's a whole genome sequencing test, which is the most accurate way to do genome sequencing. It picks up everything that's in the system, viruses, fungus, everything, bacteria, of course. And it's designed around functionality of the gut. So you actually look at the microbes in the system from the perspective of the functions that they elicit in the gut, or the dysfunctions that they elicit. So then what you really get to understand is, what are the functional groups in your microbiome that tend to be predominant, and what functions are they driving, or what functions are you missing from the gut microbiome? So it's the most practical, actionable microbiome test, because every single thing that the test, every output that the test has, also comes with recommendations on things you can do to modulate that, should you need to modulate it, right? Both diet, lifestyle, and then also from a supplement perspective. So everything you can take action on. It gives you more insight into your microbiome, your health, the things that affect you, than you can get from many other things that you might actually spend money on testing. The vaginal microbiome test was a very important passion project for us, because we're seeing more and more that fertility rates are dropping quite significantly among both men and women. In men, it's the case of testosterone. In women, fertility rates have dropped quite significantly. If I'm not mistaken, something around 30% in the last 10 years, which is really scary when you think about it, and it continues to decline. One of those drivers of fertility issues is a dysbiotic vaginal microbiota. We see that vaginal BV, bacterial vaginosis rates keep going up. We see UTIs keep going up, yeast infections keep going up. So all of these signs of vaginal dysbiosis keep going up. So we want women and their practitioners to have access to understanding what their vaginal microbiome looks like, right? You may have symptoms, you may not, but you just don't know whether your vaginal microbiome is trending in the wrong direction, especially important when you're reaching areas like perimenopause, menopause, or you're reaching fertility age where you're actually thinking about having kids, or you're going into that menopausal state where hormone balance is critically important. And one of the side effects of having a dysbiotic vaginal microbiome is you start getting vaginal dryness and hormone imbalances and all kinds of things that are just really disrupt quality of life. So we want you to have be able to have a simple handle that gives you really good, accurate information on what the vaginal microbiome looks like. And then there's also some recommendations on things you can do about it.
Very cool. Are the microbiome tests ever covered by insurance? Have you ever seen that happen?
So I've had some people say that they've been able to, if their doctor orders it, they've been able to use their flex spending accounts or the health savings accounts to cover it. But insurance is a nightmare to me. So the only way to get it officially covered with on the insurance with like a billing code and all that is if you add a PCR component to it, right? That's the only thing that insurance companies approve as a diagnostic type of test. And so we've been thinking about trying to add a PCR to it. It's not going to give us great, good information, but just one of those bureaucratic things that it says, oh, if it has a PCR, this is a billing code. So then you might be able to cover it through normal insurance. But if you have a flex spending or health savings account, that may be something you might be able to get reimbursed for.
So if you, so usually to buy through Microbiome Labs, you have to have a practitioner. What Kieran has done for my community, thank you so much, is allowing you to order directly from them with our patient direct code, SIBOSOS. Is that right? Is that the right code, Clarissa? Anyway, it might be Digestion SOS. So Clarissa will pop it in there. She already has. So check out the chat, you guys. There it is. Use no bloat. The patient direct code is SIBOSOS. Thank goodness. Okay. No bloat 15 to get 15% off. What do you think about C. diff? We have a couple of people really struggling with it. How can we support them?
We did a study and published, again, the research becomes super important, right? We don't want to make assumptions. We did a study with Cleveland Clinic, their integrative health center, one of the biggest in the country. And we did a study and published on C. diff using Megaspore. What we were able to show is that the Megaspore strains have the ability to compete against Clostridium difficile, thereby controlling their function in the gut, right? If you have ongoing recurrent C. diff, of course, hopefully you're talking to your doctor and getting the right medical advice for it. But if you're looking at a probiotic that may be able to help with supporting that whole balance issue that leads to C. diff proliferating, then Megaspore is one that we have a published study showing that it does compete against Clostridium difficile. And wow, we've used it in our Chicago clinic for years now. For people that continue to struggle with it.
Wow. Okay. It's 4:04. Do I need to let you go or do you have another few minutes?
I'm okay. I'm good with a few minutes. Okay.
Oh, good. Does Serene Skin work on psoriasis?
We did not study it for psoriasis. Okay. So I can't say with any definitiveness. What I can tell you is that we've had a number of patients with generalized inflamed skin conditions, right? So things like psoriasis, eczema, rosacea, these are all kind of inflammatory pathologies in the skin. And depending on the types of microbes you have on your skin, it'll either present as atopic dermatitis or eczema or psoriasis. But many of the pathologies, underlying pathologies, are the same. And so, you know, we've seen improvements in many of those types of patients. We're doing some case studies right now, specifically on psoriasis eczema, to see how those patients respond. But in general, we haven't studied them, so I don't want to say yes, okay, right? Yeah. But we've seen that anecdotally.
Listen, there's a book called The Keystone Method, which is on Amazon. And my sister has psoriasis terribly. I have it. It's very much so much better. And the book Keystone Method is actually a SIBO book. Like, I read the book and I'm like, this is a small intestine bacterial overgrowth book. What's happening here? And she talks about the research associated with different strains of probiotics helping psoriasis. And if you have SIBO, chances are you have a higher proclivity towards psoriasis. So definitely get that book. definitely give it a try, guys. I love the Megaspore combined with the Serene Skin. That's helped me personally. So the book is called The Keystone Method. And the keystone is the same word Kieran's been talking about, which is that gatekeeper. It was a phenomenal, phenomenal book. So L. Hermitage Kin probiotic tape went on Cipro. We've talked about the different protocols. Go ahead and scroll up in the chat. You'll see the protocol for taking on antibiotic. And is it too late to take Megaspore if you've had persistent C. diff 3 years ago after antibiotics treated with vancomycin for 5 months? Is it too late? It's never too late. Go ahead.
It's never too late. I mean, it's an ecological issue, right? It may be harder to start reversing things, but it can be done. And so never have the mentality that it's too late. When it comes to your gut, your microbiome, of course, your health in general, it's never too late to make improvements. And with ecological issues, which is what your gut is, it's an complex ecology, you can always make improvements.
And what's the best way to store your products? To slow or freeze the rate of potency loss? Would be nice if you could mention after how much time potency starts to decrease a little bit.
If you're looking at the probiotics, potency doesn't decrease. We've tested it upwards of 5 years after it's manufactured, and we see 100% potency as the day of manufacturing, right? And that's another important aspect of these types of strains is that because they're designed by nature to be out in the environment and use the environment as a vector to get in, they're naturally stable in the outside environment. So yes, you won't see any potency loss. If you have a bottle that all of a sudden you found in the back of your closet and it's 5-6 years old, it likely works exactly the same as it did when you bought it. So there's no issue there. I think we put 2 or 3 years shelf life on the product, only because from a legal FDA, all that standpoint, you really can't put more than that. It becomes a big question if you do. So that's why we put, I think, 2 or 3 years, but there's no loss of potency over time.
Okay. Holly is asking, for H. pylori, does Pylorguard help with, I don't know how to say this word, coccoid forms? C-O-C-C-O-I-D?
Yeah, of the H. pylori, yes. Yeah. So there are, you know, you can have almost 200 different types of Helicobacter pylori that elicits different types of responses in the body. But yes, in our studies, and keep in mind, we have, I think, 11 published studies on this product. Right? 11 published human trials on this product. It's not just, it didn't just come out yesterday. We've been working on this for some time. And we have 2 more ongoing studies right now on it. So but before long, we'll have 13 published studies on this product. And yes, it does work on all forms that we've seen in people.
That's awesome. That's been 11. Wow. That's amazing.
11 published studies on this. I'd say, just off the top of my head, adding it up, almost 500 patients through these studies. So quite a bit. Oh,
thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Lara. Lara is correcting the name of my book suggestion. It is The Keystone Approach, not The Keystone Method. Thank you so much. I looked over there. I don't know if you saw me doing that because the book is in the other room. I thought it was on my bookshelf. It's The Keystone Approach. It's really a SIBO book and a microbiome book. And so I got the author's point, but I wish she just said it's a psoriasis SIBO book. Okay. Thank you very much, Lara. I appreciate that. Okay. Let's see. Auto brewery syndrome. Have you heard of that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. And what are your suggestions for that? And then we'll wrap up. Thanks everybody for
being here. So one of my favorite products has been out for almost a year, but it came back last month, finally. Mega Mycobalance is such a good, well thought out product in terms of how to deal with yeast and fungal issues in the gut, right? And the whole autobrewery syndrome issues around yeast and its ability to make alcohol out of substrates that you eat, like carbohydrates. So it's producing alcohol derivatives and aldehydes and things like that in your gut that actually have a impact on your brain and, of course, your blood alcohol levels without you having to be able to enjoy the fun of drinking. So it's you're constantly feel like you're a little buzz or have a hangover. You know, and of course it's awful on your liver because your liver is constantly trying to process these things. So the Mega Myco Balance is a powerful, amazing product with really unique active ingredients, undecyclinic acid and the bee propolis. They both go after yeast and mold differently in the gut. And because they go after differently, they have a cool additive synergistic effect. But it was, when we had it, it was one of our most popular products. It's been out for so long, but now it's back and it's like flying off the shelf. So that's one to look at. You combine that with Megaspore, which will help restore some of the microbes in that region, and you should be doing well.
Okay. Hey, Karen, thank you so much. Everyone, we're going to send out the replay. Please type some love into the chat for Karen. I appreciate you so much. Keep up the great work. Really, really love you so much and just appreciate your mission and everything you've been doing for us. So I'll let you go. I'm just going to give a couple of little announcements here. Thanks.
Awesome. Karen. Thank you, guys. Later. Thank you, everybody, for hanging on.
Thank you. Bye. Bye. Good to see you. So be sure to use the link that we've provided along with the SIBO SOS patient direct code, and know that you know the prices are going up. I don't want to say how much for each one because I think it's a little bit different for each one. And that does happen June 1st, 2022. So take advantage of that coupon. Honestly, I was like, Kieran, this is a huge ask. Would you give us another 15% off for everybody? And he said, yes, he's so generous. And I'm just keeping my fingers crossed that he always says yes. But in the meanwhile, even if a coupon wasn't active, it's no bloat 15, by the way, is the coupon. If you're new to Microbiome Labs, you could still get that 15% off. But right now, everyone can get that if you use no bloat. So thank you all for being here. I know that Karen is highly in demand and you all have so many great questions. And we, you know, like I went 13 minutes over. I really only have them for an hour. So I did the best I could. Thank you very, very much. If you go to microbiomelabs.com, there's a ton of literature there too, that I think if you dove into, like for example, Total Gut Restoration, it has, that's a kit he has. It has like the dosages and how to use it and that kind of thing. A lot of you are asking about SIBO, small intestine bacterial overgrowth, and when to use these, hey, Amy, and how probiotics work with SIBO. So we just did a Q&A with Dr. Allison Seebecker, and Digestive Disease Week is happening right now, the largest worldwide digestive conference for gastroenterologists, et cetera. And on the other side of it, there's going to be, like it's actually happening right now, announcements and new research updates. So probiotics are obviously a hot topic. They don't work for everyone. Everyone also has their own unique microbiome. There are studies that show that taking probiotics can assist with symptoms of IBS and help with SIBO. However, Dr. Seebecker has not seen that clinically in her world. She can help with some symptoms, but it isn't like the killing stages and the elemental diet and the antibiotics and the herbals, antimicrobials. She hasn't seen that. If someone like wants to go the distance, maybe do something probiotics during the killing treatment, she says, go for that, try it, see how you do. But one thing she just suggests is once you do the killing treatment and you're like 90% better, she doesn't love to have people rock the boat at that time with probiotics. So I'm just sharing with you what she just has been teaching for so long and as she has seen in her, you know, thousands and thousands of successful cases of resolving SIBO. So Amy's asking, do any of these supplements reduce Klebsiella levels? Because Dr. Mark Pimentel has proven that the overgrowth of Klebsiella E. coli is the some of the bacteria that is overgrowing in small intestine bacterial overgrowth in SIBO. So I can totally appreciate your question, Amy. So remember that overgrowth is dysregulating the microbiome. And that once those, I don't know if you saw Dr. Pimentel's presentation on February 14th at the, I know it's in the materials that you have, because you're in the SIBO Recovery Roadmap course. Once those levels are down, a homeostasis came back into the small intestine. So that's why I really wanted Kieran to talk about the gatekeepers and the keystone strains, because you have some bad players, as Dr. Pimentel says, and when those bad players are wreaking havoc, then, you know, it really is a neighborhood gone bad. And so that's why you want these keystone strains to help bring balance back into the neighborhood. I hope that that is clear as mud. I hope that's clear. So I can see why, Amy, you want to reduce those Klebsiella overgrowth. And this is helping the keystone strains support that. So Dr. Pimentel and Dr. Seebecker are talking about reduce the amounts of the Klebsiella and then bring harmony back. What's interesting is that Dr. Pimentel also has found that what he has seen clinically, that when those strains of the bad players are reduced, the homeostasis comes back, which I found fascinating. I found it so fascinating. So I love doing my Serene Skin and my Megaspore. And then if I've ever had to do an antibiotic, I do the HU58 and I do the Prescriptassist. And I've found that to be super, super helpful. I've done so many antibiotics in my day. I know that has contributed to my SIBO along with my food poisoning episodes from back when I was 5 and forward. And this has just really worked well for me, along with doing the killing protocol and then, you know, all of the roadmap and the algorithm that Dr. Seebecker and I teach. So I just wanted to clarify a couple of those points. If you do have SIBO, you do have SIFO, go slow, really start slow, because anybody who's sensitive, you all know who you are. You're afraid of a flare, you have an autoimmune situation. Start slowly. I'm not giving you medical advice. I'm just giving you the advice that I've heard over the years of having these exact same questions. So what's slow? For a lot of us, taking like one capsule feels slow, but did you hear what he said? It's like half a capsule every other day for like a week and see how you do. I also tend to be a little bit cynical myself, where I feel like, oh, what could this one capsule do, right? Like, how could this have caused that? Or how could this one little thing help? But these are very powerful strains. And so don't underestimate them. And I do want to encourage you all to start slowly. Okay. Thank you very, very much. Of course, Karen, we're going to be sharing it. We will send out the recording ASAP, and be sure to click the link that we'll also put with it, which will show you Kieran's older or previous presentations, because they are a treasure trove. Just play it in the background as like a podcast, because his information is so spectacular. He does talk fast. And so I like to put it on like a little bit of a slower speed for the replay, so you can kind of hear it a little bit more slowly. I hope that helps. Thank you all so much for being here. Do mark your calendars in terms of a save the date for a couple of things. One is June 13th, Dr. Mark Pimentel and Dr. Allison Seebecker will be joining me for a live to talk about the discoveries and the announcements at Digestive Disease Week. And then Kieran is back next month. You know, all this is subject to change, okay? But so far, this is the schedule. Scanning, yep. It's May 23rd. So in a month, June 24th, 1 to 2 Eastern time, we have Kieran back as well. So I'm really looking forward to those. And then I have Steve Wright coming back on June 27th at 3 p.m. Eastern. He's going to be talking about digestive enzymes, tributarine, and the immune system, leaky gut as well. Okay. Take advantage of these coupons while they're existing. I don't know if anything is low in stock right now. That makes me a little bit nervous, because you cannot carry the coupon forward into, you know, beyond the expiration date, which is the 31st of the month, because the prices go up on the June 1st, by the way. So that's what I had to say. Thank you all so much. Thanks, Clarissa, for being here. And Rukshana, if you're in Winter Park, Florida, I know you have that client who is really struggling. Has she tried ozone? Is a question that I have for you. If she would be interested in doing a second opinion with Dr. Alana Gervich, who specializes in Crohn's, she is in Portland, Oregon. Gervich, G-U-R-E-V-I-C-H, definitely worth a consult before the girl has her colon taken out. And Dr. Gervich specializes in Crohn's, colitis, IC, and really has had some remarkable results with ozone. So I don't know of another GI doctor in Florida, other than Dr. Michael Shulman, who is my personal gastroenterologist, who's in Largo, Florida, who is really gifted, really a wonderful, wonderful doctor. So that's what I have to say. I hope your patient gets the help that she needs. My heart goes out to her big time. Wait, there's somebody else. Joel Spreckman. I'm going to type it in. Joel Spreckman. He is a friend of mine. You're welcome, Gloria. Lena, it's at 1:30 Eastern time so far for Dr. Pimentel on June 13th. Subject to change, but that's what we have right now. Joel Spreckman is online on just like a, you know, an educator online, and he is a specialist in Crohn's. He has Crohn's, and he has some very, I would say, outside of the box approach to healing, and has gone through hell himself. So that would be someone that I would reach out to, or at least see what he's been up to online with his educational. Okay, good. Okay, so Anonymous, who's it safe to take Megaspore if you have both SIBO and SIFO? I've pretty much gotten under control. So is under control symptom management, or is under control like you're testing negative? So that's an interesting question. You need a SIBO doc in Boston. I know, you can go to our speaker list at SIBO SOS Facebook group. Clarissa, I can tell, has popped it in there, and there is a list of our speakers. Nancy, I got something for you. Do not hesitate to use some of these telemedicine doctors. I was totally freaked out and opposed to doing telemedicine. And this was pre-COVID. This was, you know, when telemedicine became in vogue. But back in 2015, when I finally had my first appointment with Dr. Seebeck. Remember, 1 hour appointment with a telemedicine specialist who specializes in SIBO is worth 5 hours, 10 hours with another practitioner who does not specialize the cat in SIBO. So please check that out. There is also a SIBO group, Facebook group for Florida. So I was thinking about you, Rakshana. Maybe there's some GI doctors listed in Winter Park. Boston. So I don't know any gastroenterologists in Boston. However, I do know a doctor in Exeter, New Hampshire, and that is Dr. Cabral, C-A-B-R-A-L. He's with Core Physicians. He isn't a SIBO expert, but he is open to thinking outside the box. So I don't know if you want, you know, do the drive or whatever. Okay. Wrapping it up. Bye, Clarissa. I don't know anyone in the Bay Area. I'm so sorry, Barbara. Thanks everybody. Cabral, I think that's it. Clarissa, if you just go to Core Physicians or Exeter Hospital, there aren't that many gastroenterologists there. Okay. Thank you. I'll talk to you next time. I'm going to go now. Bye.